Hello. Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, James Jones, and it is October 6th, 2016, the first episode of October, and the last episode before the 7th Annual Nintendo World Report Telethon in support of Child's Play. I am joined today by Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Bonjour.
Did you like how I slid that plug in there? It was people didn't even notice.
Seamless, huh?
Yeah, it was a good setup. Also joined today with Mr. Greg Leahy.
Oi, oi, everyone.
And again, because his metamorphosis is continuing and his cocoon hasn't quite hatched, John is out this week. We're hopeful that he will be a full butterfly by next week's telethon. We're joined instead by Mr. N. McNulty.
Hey.
It's good to have you back.
Good to be back.
You will have a segment during the telethon. I am afraid.
It is 1 hour to myself. Everyone else can go relax while I burn the whole thing down.
I mean, that's going to happen regardless of if you're there. Have you ever listened to this telethon?
Yes, but mine is before your and John's segment.
I have the kill button the entire 13 and a half hours. Don't mess around too much. So yeah, I am the keeper of the peace on the telethon. So what will you be doing during the telethon, since the schedule is out there, but there's a little bit of detail ambiguity on that particular segment?
I will be having a call-in where listeners can call in and pitch a game idea if they've been having one just all their life. They've thought, I want this type of game, and I'm out of the game design, game directorial phase of making my games, and so I kind of miss that. And so people can come in and we can talk about it. I can talk about strengths and weaknesses and if it would work or not, and from a realistic perspective.
So I have a game idea where you play as a guy in overalls with a mustache and he jumps on turtles.
Is it anything to do with a certain illustrious former FIFA president? That's my pitch.
No, he jumps on turtles, but only for 1 million euros.
Oh yeah, you'll do that. You just pay for play.
I believe it's called Super Mario Run and Ship It.
Done. I am now an accomplished video game designer. Speaking of accomplished video game designers, by the way, it's episode 495. It's time for new business, and Seren, you'll be leading off the show about an Italian man in overalls with a mustache who apparently is now only 24 years old.
He's 24 years old, and he's never looked thinner. I hate myself.
You have played this game too much, because you are now making puns from this game.
So this game is Paper Mario Color Splash, and it is the Wii U game of the second half of 2016.
It sure is.
That's not fair. There were at least three. Mighty Number Nine.
Tokyo Mirage Sessions. Oh, I'm talking games that are worth playing.
Mighty Number Nine.
No. Paper Mario Color Splash. Mostly what I have to say about Color Splash is that my experience mirrors what a lot of online reviewers have said, which is the script is some of the best localization I've ever seen, and it is Treehouse firing on all cylinders. Full disclosure, I know some of the people who wrote for this game, but in all seriousness, it is hilarious. It is the funniest game I've played this year. It looks beautiful. It looks criminally good. It sounds fantastic. And I guess it plays.
Is it better in just in terms of gameplay? Is it preferable to Sticker Star?
Yes.
Does it feel like they listened a bit on that game and made some corrections?
Yes.
Okay.
Things are no longer as punishing. Things are no longer as obtuse. Things are no longer. It is no longer you've solved the puzzle but have no idea where the thing is.
Hmm.
Which happened at least three times for me in Sticker Star, where they would show a puzzle and you wouldn't get the thing for another 10 hours.
Whoa.
Yeah, where you would get a bunch of bowling pins like 3 hours into the game, and 13 hours into the game, you would find a bowling ball. And you get to go backtrack.
Oh.
That was Sticker Star, though. This is Color Splash. It still has elements. It is very much that the Sticker Star Color Splash formula seems to be where they're gonna stay with Paper Mario. And if you can accept it for what it is and look past what it isn't, it's a great looking and sounding game that is hilarious. The battle system, there are two halves of the battle system, running away from enemies and fighting once they catch you, because there is no explicit reward from battle except for coins and refilling your paint, which in some environments where it's difficult to refill your paint on a whim, battles are how you will refill your paint. There is the mechanic of you have battle cards on the game pad, and those are the equivalent of your stickers, and you choose, are you cocky enough to just use the battle card, or do you paint it in to be able to have more power and use things like action commands? And there's paint conservation and battle card conservation, and in the levels, a lot of the area as part of the story, a lot of the areas are deprived of paint, and so you go and you cover it back up with you like you fill in the monochromatic areas of the environment with the paint. Then you refill the paint either through blocks or enemies or refill. And it's all right. Do not, whatever you do, think of it as an RPG. Think of it as an adventure game that has combat as a mechanic. If you think of it as an adventure game, you're not, or as if you think of it as an RPG, especially as a JRPG, you are going to be incredibly disappointed. There's still no experience, there's still no levels. But it feels more rewarding than Sticker Star. It has more content than Sticker Star. The content feels less recycled than Sticker Star. And the script, Sticker Star really didn't have a script. It felt like a Mario platformer script. You got some jokes at the beginning, you got some jokes in World 3, and you got some jokes at the end in Sticker Star. In Color Splash, they are leaning into it is like a film noir, but also just a complete comedy, and it is hilarious. There's some really dark jokes that will go over kids' heads, but adults will probably completely enjoy. I don't know how much pay. Either a younger player is going to have all the patience in the world for this game, or they're going to just get really bored by it, and I can't actually tell which.
It'll be different for different kids, but yeah, I can imagine what you mean there, yeah.
It's there are I can easily imagine a kid getting just bored to tears by this game, and I can imagine a kid wanting to try every silly animation and funny joke in every context.
But I mean, it ultimately comes down to what your kid likes. And if you think they would have the patience for this, then
If you think that they would have an advent the patience for a point-and-click adventure game, they would have the patience for this. And for adults and young adults and parents, I recommend it if you are looking for a funny, gorgeous game on your Wii U and you can overlook its gameplay faults. Because it does have gameplay faults, it is not perfect. It's not Game of the Year material here, but it is the funniest game I've played this year.
But one practical question about the sort of off TV play stuff, because
None.
It does have it. I think I saw that confirmed during E3. But like with the cards and all this kind of stuff that was mentioned being on the gamepad, like how does it function in practice? Is it fiddly, like
I've
switching between screens, or did you never use it?
never used it, didn't think it had it.
Oh, really? Oh, well.
I've played it, and that's news to me that it had it. I didn't go looking for it. But no, the in battle, you get a giant list, a horizontal scrolling list of all of your cards, and you just keep scrolling back and forth and back and forth to find the card you want. Kind of like a Rolodex.
Interesting, because I certainly read a review or two, I think, that referenced it as well. But yeah, so I was wondering, like,
I
how does that
would not be
work
the
in
person for
practice,
that.
given what I'd seen of how they were gonna, put the cards down there?
My best guess is, remember Xenoblade?
Yeah, well, it was workable. I use that a
Yeah.
lot. If it's like
That's my
that,
best guess
that'd be
then.
fine. It's not. It's a little fiddly, but it's it helped
Back and
me play
forth.
Xenoblade for many,
Yeah.
many, many hours. So I
That's
could
my
do
best
that.
guess. I am grateful that I am not in a position where I need to use off TV play frequently. I love having it there in case I want it for like a virtual console game, especially play on basically the world's largest Game Boy Advance screen. But no, I frankly don't know. And it's fairly replayable. It's as replayable as like a LucasArts adventure game might be. In that you'll know the jokes. The jokes aren't all one note. So if you come back to it a few months later, I would assume that you'll still be laughing at it, but you'll know the puzzle solutions.
Right. You're essentially just re-experiencing the humor at that point.
Yeah. Re-experiencing the humor and re-experiencing the progression. It's not like Thousand Year Door, for instance, and I know people are going to riot that I'm saying that in reference to Color Splash, but it is not like Thousand Year Door, which had bat like and original Paper Mario, which had badges and you could play in completely different play styles. It is more of an adventure game. And
Okay.
if you are comfortable going in at whatever asking price you could find the game for, wanting a gorgeous high production value adventure game, then I believe you will thoroughly enjoy Color Splash.
So for Guillaume, that's what, $1,300?
Something like that.
Yeah, actually, it's $86 with taxes.
Good
It's
Lord.
great. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe a bit much. And I even Canadian, and I'm aware of Canadian exchange, that's not a fair exchange.
It's not.
Yeah, and then the game took me like.
Okay, so it's a relatively short experience.
Yes, it's not like a 50-hour long thing. At least it wasn't for me.
And that's what it sounds like. It sounds like it's more of an experience than anything.
Yes.
You're really going through for the presentation, for the writing, for the kind of the world and all the goofiness in it.
Exactly.
You're not digging so much in for like, I want to have. It's sort of the. I would say it's sort of the anti-Xenoblade in that way, but in Xenoblade, the world is a really compelling thing. But it's the mechanics and the exploration and stuff that make that game work.
And here it is all, yeah, it is not quite entirely the inverse, but it is, you are there, you would be buying in to experience the story they have for you and the writing they have for you and the characters that they have for you.
Right.
And most of those characters are toads. And frankly, I am dead sick of toads. Mario Party, I don't like, but even that's all toads now. Mario, the last Mario and Luigi game, toads everywhere.
Mario Party, Toadist Party.
All of these toads in the last two Paper Mario games. I am really growing to hate Toad. Toad is the mascot of Japanese Nintendo social media.
Yes, Kinopo.
Nice.
Yes, Kinopio-kun. That's a good transition.
Oh God, because things are about to get real Japanese, aren't they? Oh
Yeah.
boy, here we go. All right, so if you are for whatever reason super afraid of hearing any conversation about Persona 5, not because of spoilers, but because of conversations about Dick Chariot monsters, check back in like 15 minutes. All right, Seren, it's all yours.
All right, see ya.
So I'm not going to talk spoilers.
Guillaume is also Toads, by the way.
I'm not going to talk spoilers at all. So I beat Persona 4. Sorry, Persona 5.
Five.
I've beaten 4, for sure. I've beaten Persona 5 two times and a little bit into a third just to finish up my platinum. I have the platinum trophy for that game. I have completed it 100%. The 100% completion time across all of my playthroughs was 136 hours. My first playthrough was 80 hours.
That's
It is possibly my favorite game of all time.
all right. That's a high start.
If you had asked me before this game came out, I've always said it was a three-way tie between Final Fantasy VI, Thousand Year Door, and Persona 4 Golden. And I still don't know which of those three I would rank above the other three, but I know Persona 5 is better. I like Persona 5 more than those three games.
So let me take a step back for a second. I'm for the purposes of expediency, I'm going to go ahead and assume that the people who are really interested in hearing about this game probably have experience with the latter day Personas.
Three and
So
four of the RPGs.
yeah, three the ones built on the three on the model that three started with.
Yes, with social links, the school life, and then the nightlife.
Yeah. Basically, you play a high school student who makes friends and also at night goes and kills demons in a place that is seemingly like a normal place, but has been turned into a weird, crazy discotheque nightmare.
And then Persona 4, it took place in another world in the day, and Persona 5 has it's during the daytime, not the nighttime.
So, assuming that the audience has some familiarity, can you speak a little bit about what they've taken from their experiences with three and four and built into five?
Okay, so the biggest thing to understand is that this Persona 3 was a 2005-2006 PS2 game. Persona 4 was a 2008 PS2 game. This
A
is a two.
2008 PS2 game.
Yes, Oh yeah. It came out this one week after Wii Music came out in North America.
Burning up the charts.
And Persona 5 is a 2016 PS3, PS4 game. It takes place in Tokyo. There are people everywhere. There are cities everywhere, or city areas everywhere. There's dozens of different environments for you to visit. The character models animate, the faces move. Like, small things that you would take for granted, but I played some of P4 today and I looked back and I said, yeah, that was a PS2 game. This was absolutely that was the best I could do on PS2, and I still love those games. This blows them out of the water from a technical and a presentational perspective. In terms of smart changes they've made, a lot of the relationship aspect is now more evenly balanced between daytime and nighttime, where in P4 you could move around in the nighttime, especially in Golden, but there were only two social links during the night and there were about 20 during the day.
And so, to give a little background, social links are essentially chains of events that you can trigger by talking to people when they're available to
Yes.
improve a relationship with them, and doing so unlocks, different attributes of the Shin Megami Tensei environment, like the ability to make a new persona and stuff like that.
Yes. So in Persona 5, well, the Japanese name of Social Link was always Community, and the Japanese name in Persona 5 is Cooperation. It's finally turned into a I scratch your back, you scratch mine. So, like, I'll hit rank 5 with you and I'll help you out with your problem, but in exchange, you're gonna teach me better negotiate with demons or how to fix negotiation with demons because demon negotiation is back in. They stripped it out of P3 from P1 and P2 and all of the Megami Tensei games to make it more beginner friendly. They kept it out of P4 and it's back in with P5 and spend a lot of time focusing on one cooperation. Your party members who'd never set foot in battle will gain experience. Some other core aspects of gameplay open up through the cooperations, which is a really interesting way for them to have handled it, because a lot of the cooperations you might miss or you might not be able to access for months after they become available because your parameters, like your knowledge and your courage, and your charisma, aren't high enough. It becomes interesting where the first instance of this is about three calendar weeks into the game, roughly about 8 hours into the game. You meet up with someone, and they tell you about their problem, but you won't be back there for about 50 hours.
Mm.
And you'll be talking to them regularly, but you won't be able to embark on their cooperation. But when you embark on it, the benefits are strong, which also means that in a new game plus environment where you carry over your parameters, you can start that right away.
Right, because you have stats you have to boost before you can continue them beyond a certain point.
Exactly. Or, for instance, this specific one, you needed almost maximum courage stat. And you start with 1 out of 5, and you need 4 out of 5 for this person.
And no, you don't earn them by killing demons. There's no courage involved in that.
No, you watch DVDs, you play video games, and you drink hot coffee.
Whenever I think about playing Sonic Boom, I need more courage.
You get a Famicom in Persona 5. One thing I'll note, I really pray that the English localization keeps away from some of the English, because there is so much English in the Japanese version, because they are trying to make Tokyo. They are trying to make Shibuya. They are trying to have a game arcade where I assume the developers looked up, what's an English word for a man who plays? And so it is called Game Center Gigolo.
I'm okay with that.
You have
That's also this podcast name, by the way.
I was just going to say, if John was here, he'd be noting that down for episode titles.
You also have scenes where the Japanese voice actors try to speak fluent English, or what Japan thinks is fluent English.
Oh, boy.
That's going to get dubbed out, and I'm really sad about that. Once you finish the game, you should look up. There will be an obvious cutscene, and you should look that Japanese version up once you finish the game. But there is no filler in this game. There is. It is lean.
So when you say filler, what would you say it would be filler-esque that is missing?
In P3, being told, I don't know, there's over 200 floors of this dungeon. And the song never changes.
Well, yeah, that's not filler. That's just awful.
And, like, here you go, keep going. And here's just this 6-week in-game calendar period where there's no story.
Right. Well, and random dungeons are gone too, though, aren't they?
No. So there is a Tartarus-like structure in the Japanese version called Mementos. That is a side dungeon where all your side quests take place, and that is procedurally generated, and that is fun. It is silly. The side quests are dark. If you've watched the Persona 5 animation, The Daybreakers, that is the story equivalent, that is the anime equivalent of one of the side quests. Mm. But the main quests, the dungeons are... Honestly, I would compare them to mid to high tiered Zelda dungeons. They are giant labyrinthine puzzles that each one has brand new mechanics that are constantly getting introduced. You're getting introduced to new mechanics 2 hours before the game ends that all happen to have stealth and combat in common, because you will be playing some of this game stealthily. You'll be ducking behind corners, waiting for an enemy to go along their patrol route so you can stun them and get ahead in combat. It's a lot more thoughtful. The dungeons are so much better. It's night and day. It is seriously night and day. Think about a Persona 4 dungeon where it is... Like, there is an end boss that you know about, and there is a unique setting for it. But then imagine that instead of procedurally generated, you were playing a Zelda dungeon and enemy encounters were RPG combat.
Okay. Because it feels like in the 3-4 games, the dungeon was really just a thing you had to get through. And sometimes it became like it wasn't an attraction. It was just a thing that had to happen. Because sometimes they felt very much like the old Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, where it's like, oh, here's the start and here's the end. The stairs are next to each other. Okay, next floor.
Oh no! Like you are progressing. You are memorizing passwords. You are gambling. You are cracking code. You're cracking codes. You're opening doors that will allow you to get through in the future. There are save points frequently in the dungeon, and you can teleport between the save points so that you can, because they are not, especially in your first run, you will not be able to finish the entire dungeon in one run. Your SP will run out. You will need to take multiple calendar days. Full disclosure, I played on hard mode, but I've heard that even on easy, you run out of SP. You need to take it one day at a time. You need to make progress. They are projects. They are very intelligently designed because it is not procedural. Because they know you have to be in a certain place at a certain point in the progression through the dungeon, they wrap a lot more story into the dungeon progression itself.
Good.
You also have the texting mechanic from Catherine, except instead of the weird type backspace, you just get a dialogue tree. And that's how corporations let you know when they want to talk to you, and that's how a lot of the story progresses, because in P4, the whole group just sticks together every single day, and in P5, they just text each other.
So, obviously, very high praise.
Yes.
Let's get a little bit more just like brief mechanics. When is the game finally effing coming out in North America?
February 14th, Valentine's Day. I have absolute faith. Especially because there was some English voice acting in the Japanese 1.0 build that got patched out.
Nice.
They accidentally put the wrong voice track in. So
How does that...
Because the localization dialogue's already been recorded.
But, like, how does somebody during the test playthrough go, hey, that person spoke English, that's weird.
Same way that Shin Megami Tensei 4 Apocalypse had some untranslated Japanese text.
Oh, that's right, it did.
It was in a hidden place. But I found
Atlas.
It.
I found it. Atlas, goddammit.
Morgana just said an English line once.
That's great. So, yeah, it sounds like this is something to mark calendars for.
Yes.
Well, I think we need to move on. Do you have, like, one last thought you want to say?
The game has been out for less than a month in Japan, and there's $100 of DLC.
Most of it to dress up like characters from other games.
Yes. If do you want to play as the half-unnamed protagonists from Shin Megami Tensei if the Super Famicom game? Well, you're in luck. Pay us 800 yen.
$8. Great. I'm looking forward to that. All right. So, Guillaume.
Yes.
We're talking about Shadows. Talk to me about some Shadows.
Oh, boy.
That's a transition.
It sure is.
I did a good job.
Debatable.
But then you kind of put the brakes.
No.
Okay. You kind of screwed it up. But
no,
anyway.
I didn't. Continue.
So I never owned an Xbox 360. And so there were a lot of XBLA games that I heard about a lot and never got to play. And one of those games was Shadow Complex, a game that I would have been very interested to play back when it came out, you know, all those years ago. The game got a remaster version on Steam and, you know, well, on PC in general, on Epic's own launcher, which doesn't seem to serve any purpose except to, I don't know. Anyway, we don't need
to
get into that.
They didn't want to give Steam a cut of their money.
Yeah.
That's its purpose.
Sure, but they were giving away, so I got this game for free, because when it came out, it was kind of a surprise. I don't think that it was announced beforehand. It was like, all of a sudden, hey guys, we've got Shadow Complex Remastered here, and you can get it for free if you download our Epic Launcher. So I did that. It was, you know, like the Took a while because everyone was trying to download it at the same time, but I managed to get a copy, and then I proceeded to not play it for 8 months. But then I played it. And it's not a very good remaster. Like, I can't compare it to my memories of the original version because I don't have them. But I've went back and I read some reviews and of the remaster, and they all say that they did the bare minimum of work on this.
Yes.
Like, basically, they switched engines, and that was pretty much it. Like, they switched it out from the Unreal Engine 3 to 4.
Right.
And they were like, okay, that's a job well done. So the game does not look very good. And it's especially dated in that, you know, you've got these meat puppets kind of, you know, just gesticulating and talking at each
well,
other.
Well, okay.
I don't know. Like, it really, the 3D-ness, the 3D, the 2.5D look really works against this game, in my opinion. I was excited to play this because, you know, like, I knew that it was kind of a faithful clone of Super Metroid, but the 3D graphics ruined it a little bit for me.
It was well received as a Metroidvania in the era where those had really been relegated to GBA games.
2006. Yeah, sure.
Or DS Castlevania games.
Yeah. Right. But then I play this, and I've been sick of grays and browns for so many years now, and this is all that this game has to offer.
It's an Unreal Engine 3 game, Guillaume.
That's what it does. I know, but you're exploring this kind of underground terrorist lair, and it's all, you know, like grays, like all metal, all boring, you know, like tons of boring looking things. So it's not that great. I don't know. There's nothing to look at. There's no eye candy here. It's really dull. It's really drab. It is literally and figuratively dull. Yeah. And because of the 2.5D thing going on, there's a lot of times where I found that the game strained my eyes a little bit because I was always trying to make out the details of what was going on. And I think that that's partly because there's so many things like in the background and the foreground that kind of look like they might be exactly where they need to be for you to grab onto them. You know, they look like stage elements that you can interact with. I think my eyes spent a lot of time trying to kind of decipher, to parse what's going on the screen, trying to figure out what you can interact with and what you can't. So, yeah, it's not a pleasant experience. It was giving me literally headaches to play it. Yeah, so I don't know. Like, it's almost like slavishly copying Super Metroid. It's kind of crazy. You've got like the quote-unquote real world, or I don't know, edgy 2006 equivalent of every weapon that Samus has, every tool that Samus has. So instead of grappling beam, it's just a grapple, of course. You've got a double jump. Instead of shooting, you know, energy beams or whatever at creatures, you shoot actual guns at actual humans. The shooting...
Terrorists.
Sure, yeah, faceless. They've all got masks. They're probably robots. Don't worry about it.
Just in Germany.
speaking of the shooting, they managed to screw that up by having enemies in the background that you sometimes have to shoot at, and the game will quote unquote automatically aim at them. Except it doesn't really work all that well, and it's just kind of a pain in the ass to try. Like, you're trying to shoot the dude who's shooting rockets at you from right in front of you, but your dude just insists on trying to target the guy in the background who's hiding behind a box.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people talk about 2.5D, you know, when it's just like a side scroller with polygonal graphics, but I think more meaningfully is where you've got this sort of like, yeah, it does crowbar in like some kind of Z-axis gameplay, you know, like good foreground, background or something like that. And I gotta say, it's not usually a plus for me, unless it's, you know, it doesn't sound that appealing. That was one of the things I didn't sound as appealing about this. I was in a similar boat to Guillaume in terms of, you know, I heard a lot about it. Sounded appealing, but I didn't get a 360 until It was gifted to me by James and John and Johnny and all on my departure in 2012, and it kind of, yeah, that point in time wherein it was a real novelty on a console had kind of passed, very much so. Mm-hmm. So I had not got around to it. So, but you know, I've still kind of.
I mean, we viewed that as the Radiant Silver.
Yeah,
purchase,
that,
so, yeah.
That was the far more pertinent component of the. I'm disappointed they haven't put that on the backwards compatibility yet, because you know then I could just play it on my Xbox One, which would be more convenient at this point. But
I thought it
Ikaruga
was,
is,
isn't it?
Ikaruga.
Oh, well, you mean Radiant Silvergun. You don't mean Shadow Colossus.
Yeah, oh, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yes,
sorry.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Sorry.
James.
I changed topics.
James
briefly.
Took us there. Yeah, but yeah. And there's the remaster version anyway that you can get on Xbox. So, you know, I mean, yeah, there's plenty of options for me to play this. So I was kind of intrigued to hear what you have to say about it, you know. And I guess it's not the biggest rigging endorsement so far.
No. Well, it just, and I don't know, there's something really. It just feels wrong to me to transpose the Super Metroid gameplay and game design to a more, you know, more or less realistic setting. It just doesn't work, you know? Like when I'm using grenades to destroy rock outcroppings to then sneak into some hidden passage, I don't really expect the rocks to be back the next time I come around, you know? it didn't make sense in Metroid Prime either, but that kind of stuff that you had to suspend your disbelief to was kind of grandfathered in that series, right? Like, it just, I was more willing to accept it, but in this case, it's just like, what the hell? Like, they repaired those doors already, but if they've got, you know, people working on that, like, how come I'm still running around? Like, they, I don't know. Like, they seem to be, anyway.
The maintenance team is not the security team, Gio.
I guess, yeah. Ben, they work very efficiently and quietly.
There's an easy explanation for this. It's been used in video games before, I believe. Well, I'm not directly familiar with it. Nanomachines.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I didn't realize this was Hideo Kojima's Shadow Complex.
Anyway, just to, I don't know, to get to the last point that really annoyed me about this game. So the story is so fucking dumb. It's insane. So at first I didn't mind, you know, because the game starts you off as this kind of half-ducked, what's his name, like Nathan Drake. Like you're hiking in the woods in the mountains with this girl that you met at a bar the night before. And so she stumbled, like she goes off on her own, and then you realize, oh wait, she's being kidnapped by these terrorists. I guess I better remember my training that my general father gave me before I told him I didn't want to be in the army because I didn't have anything to fight for, and you know, go and save her. This is literally what happens.
I'm already on board. Let's keep going.
So you do that, and like I was like, okay, good. Like this is like she's the mutant frog in Blaster Master.
Is this
and,
Ray
the
frog
that's
to
fine.
Fight for? is this the prequel to Red Dawn? What are we doing with here?
Oh, it's pretty much as bad. But anyway, so I was fine. Like the story got out of the way pretty fast, so I was fine. But then eventually you find her. She's disabled. Like she can't move because she's been drugged. She asks you to put her behind some filing cabinets, and like she's gonna guide you somehow, talking you through an earpiece. So that goes on for a while. Eventually she gets captured. They move the filing cabinets and find her, and so. Anyway, so eventually you go save her again, and she decides, okay, so the drugs have worn off, she's gonna take the Jeep, and she's gonna go warn the authorities, and you're like, oh, I have to stay behind, you know, at the worst case scenario, I'm gonna slow them down, and, you know, maybe if I'm lucky, I'm gonna destroy the whole base. So you go do that, you destroy the whole base, she comes back with helicopters, and turns out that she's an NSA agent who specifically went to the bar to pick up a guy to destroy a terrorist base, apparently. And the reason why she didn't get her NSA chums to help out is because the terrorists had ears everywhere.
She's a very good NSA agent.
I don't know what's the proper sort of hyphenation of this, so it could be two words or one word, but one term anyway for you, Guillaume. Off book.
It's all about off-book operations, all right?
That's right.
I see. Okay.
Black flag operations.
I don't know. I just, personally, as someone who doesn't know anything about that kind of thing, it
I
seems
think you
to
just
me
described
that going...
the plot of 24 Season 5, by the way.
I think that going... Think that going clubbing in the hopes that the guy that you're going to pick up is going to destroy terrorist space for you and happens to be highly trained with weapons and everything seems like a long shot.
To be fair, the NSA knows whenever you go
clubbing. I
don't
know, it was like, it was kind of insulting, you know, like this is what gamers, I don't know, this is what developers thought gamers would accept in 2006.
Remember, this is from Epic.
Sure.
These are the people who gave us Gears of War. Like, like, keep your expectations tempered.
But see, I never.
But James, the gun has a chainsaw.
It's true. The gun has a chainsaw. I
anyway,
would say,
now I'm duly warned.
Your description though gave me sort of pangs of whatever emotion one feels when they think about the novelization of Gex. So I'm all aboard you taking up the legacy of writing the game novelizations.
Anyway, I'm bitching a lot, but like really, like it makes me question if I even like Metroidvanias in the first place.
Oh, wow!
But a lot of games make me question that. Like I think I should stop questioning. Like I don't especially like the genre. I just like specific games.
Yeah, yeah, you know, well, that works. That's true for a number of genres.
But it's just, you know, my first big one was Super Metroid. It happened to be so good it tricked me into thinking,
I'd like anything in this
thing
vein.
I love.
That is not necessarily true. Yeah.
And Area of Sorrow is really good, you know, and Metroid Prime is really good. And outside of that, I start struggling to think of, you know, examples I like.
Simon's Quest is really good.
Sure. Again, like I was going through games on my Steam backlog to get through, and I played Castle Crashers with Karen. So that was another 360 game that I skipped that turned out to be better. So that was good. But then, you know, Karen just wanted to keep beating stuff up, and we were a little bit tired. Like, we tried to start going through the game again, and it wasn't as much fun. So I fired up Streets of Rage 2 through the Sega Mega Drive and Genesis Classics emulator that's available on Steam. And
is that the actual name, the Sega Genesis and Mega Drive?
Mega Drive and Genesis. Mega Drive comes first, which makes me think maybe Sega has, like, I don't know, data somewhere that shows
but
that
they're the same thing.
I know, but the I'm guessing that maybe the contingent of Sega fans, you know, into the Mega Drive Genesis is bigger.
Is European?
Yeah,
it was for their Sega. You know, we're bigger both in the 8-bit and the 16-bit eras, you know, in Europe, relatively. Although, okay, well, of course, Mega Drive was the original name in Japan. As well, what it was called. The Genesis was
This is an English language emulator selling Western versions of games.
But Steam sells across all.
Felt like they wanted to put both in there to avoid any kind of
maybe.
So yeah, so this is an emulator that basically you buy. It's kind of like a virtual console, actually. So you can buy the games individually. They're about $3. So they're, you know, $5 cheaper than on the Wii.
Oh God, and, that's right. Yeah, I was almost going to correct you then, but they're only $6 in Japan, or 600 yen. For the Mega Drive, because the Mega Drive was more popular in the West, the price got jacked up commensurately.
800 Wii points.
Right. Well, I'm guessing that Nintendo came up with the pricing, and 16-bit is $8. That's the math.
Do the math, Jaguar.
So you can get mostly the same titles that have been on the Wii VC on this emulator. There's a lot of, you know, like you can find most Treasure games, you can find most Sega developed games. You can even find some games that you shouldn't be able to find or at least you could at a certain time because the game, the emulator allows mods. So,
yes.
For a while, people were putting up, you know, like Aladdin or, you know, games that they no one authorized. So, that was fun.
They were basically modding all the code of one game out and putting the code of another game in.
Yeah, so
it was a mod in quotes only.
I don't think they're around anymore. I haven't checked, but
Sega / Steam did police that a bit. When it launched, it was the Wild West.
Right. So one mod, you know, an example of mod that you could find is in the Streets of Rage, for instance. You can replace the death yells of the enemies by Tim Allen's kind of sound. And so that's fun. Like, if you want to hear that over and over again, you hear it a lot in Streets of Rage.
If you want to play as Goku, you can.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the mods only work when you start the game in kind of a... like the full shell. I'm using words I don't know how to use. Like when you start up the game, so you have the choice between kind of a, you know, an elaborate interface and a simple interface. And if you go through the elaborate one, like it loads a 3D
living room
rendering, like a room, like you're in your room, you've got your CRT TV there, you've got your shelf of games, and you can select them and then put them in the Genesis / Mega Drive and start them. And so, like, they kind of, you know, they went and they emulated the experience of having a room, I guess.
In case you're playing Steam outside.
Yeah, so my computer is a few years old, but it's kind of a gaming computer. Like, it's a laptop, but I bought it, I overpaid for it so that it would be good at running games. And the thing is, this interface actually impacts the quality of the emulation when you're playing the games. Yeah.
Oh my god.
So I was wondering, like, I was really struggling to find what was the problem. Because, like, Streets of Rage, like Yuzo Koshiro's excellent soundtrack, was just, you know, mangled.
No.
It was slowing down. It was just, it was bad, you know. It was still playable. We played through the whole game, but it was just, I was so disappointed. But then I realized, oh, wait, there's this simple interface here. And I used that. And then all of a sudden, then the emulation was pretty much beyond repair. Like, I was...
So you were getting frame drops?
I guess, yeah.
It had
an impact. Yeah.
I believe the way they did it is they had an emulator. These games were on Steam previously, but what they did was they relaunched it. They basically did a second grand opening of the product where they introduced mod support, and then they wrecked the whole thing in an interestingly optimized Unity package. So the emulator is the same, but the room is being rendered in Unity, and then it's calling an emulator package.
Right.
So
it's not an optimal way to do it, apparently, because even on a, I think I've got a 2.4 gigahertz like i7 core i7 i7 processor, and I've got you
should
like,
be able to emulate Genesis games. Yes,
you would think. Yeah, like 32 gigs of RAM. Like, I don't think the problem is me.
You would
think. Well, I mean the Genesis did have 64 gigs of RAM, to be fair.
It's true.
It's the blast processor that's tough to emulate. I think you know that.
It's true. Yeah.
So that
it's
was
like the Super FX chip.
So I'm not able to play with that Tim Allen.
Oh, what about you? Somebody's got to do a rapping Ronnie Reagan mod for that, where everyone says "well" when they die. That'd be amazing.
God,
you know, he did say "well" a lot.
All right, so what I'm saying is try it, maybe get one game. I got all four games that I had for it, I've gotten for free through some Sega thing, so I don't know, like they had some sort of contest. I probably traded all my info for free.
Oh, well, when the identity theft kicks in, you're pretty much a square trade.
And you're wondering how the NSA would know when you're at a discotheque. Yeah. There's your answer. They're responsible for this Genesis / Mega Drive collection Steam.
Well, they probably like administered some secret sort of quiz under the guise of your video game preferences, which determines whether you're like a high-functioning sociopath that goes to nightclubs.
There we go.
And then it goes from there.
To know if you're going to enjoy Sonic and Knuckles, we need to know your mother's maiden name.
Let me tell you about
to be fair,
the Blade Runner reference is pretty oblique.
You think the plot of Shadow Complex is unbelievable? What if I tell you the NSA wrote it? See.
They might.
It all comes full circle, and this podcast is now going to just be the sound.
The Rand Corporation, in cooperation with the Reverse Vampires, through the Looking Glass here, people.
I think, I can move on.
If you can hear this show, it's been leaked.
I think I can move on to the last point. I played a 30-minute demo of ReCore on my PC. And it ran pretty well, and all the kind of issues I heard about that game made by Armature, former, Retro Studio staff, didn't seem all that, in 30 minutes, I didn't encounter, endless load times. And, of course, I can't, testify as to how the story kind of peters out or whatever, but, it seemed, the game ended right after the tutorial, right before the first big quote-unquote dungeon, and it kind of left me wanting to play more. So I don't know. I'm probably I didn't buy it then and there because I've got Paper Mario in the mail, but
it will be on sale.
It will be.
So I played and finished and reviewed ReCore, mm-hmm. On both Xbox One and Windows 10. It's an Xbox Play Anywhere, so you buy it once, you get it both places. Cross save as well. Right. So, yeah, the PC version doesn't have the asininely long loading times, and the Xbox One version theoretically has some of that worked out. So, I got about 3 hours in, and I was telling people, wow, I really, really like this.
You were telling me that.
Yeah, this game is feeling great. Like, it would have to do something for me to not really like this game, and then I gave it a 4.
I don't remember you actively walking back your comments in our conversations.
I'm just
stopped talking about ReCore.
Yeah, no, that game falls the hell apart, and then it literally just ends. From what I believe, it literally just takes control away from you, and then just shows an ending.
So they ran out of budget.
And then it boots you back to the title screen without playing credits.
Okay. Well, it's been patched since, though.
Yeah, it has been patched, but the patch is just loading times.
Right.
I've been paying attention to that. No, that game has a really solid first couple hours, and then it just starts throwing hordes of enemies at you and starts leaning on its worst aspects. And then
the loot, I guess.
Yep. And then it just keeps doing that, and it just gets more grating and more grating, and then you're thrown back to the title screen.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll hold on to the memories of those precious 30 minutes.
Or wait for it to be $20 or less.
Yeah, probably. And I will end on this. Apparently, at some point when I created my account for Microsoft Windows, mm-hmm. It gave me a gamer tag, or I had to choose one and I didn't, so a gamer tag had been chosen for me.
Yep,
I just learned. Say hello to Clad Princess 7. I don't know what happened to Clad Princess 1 through 6, and I'm kind of scared.
They're sort of trapped in tanks somewhere, like all those Hugh Jackmans.
They're NSA agents.
No, at some point, I remember I had the same thing on an account that's to be opaque, not on a public server, and it just gave me Dim Dragon 88876.
Nice.
And I'm Lord. Thanks.
To be fair, to be honest, I'm keeping the name Clad Princess. It's better than anything I could come up with. So, kudos, Microsoft.
There you go. Clad Princess Maker. All right. So, I don't have a lot to talk about this week. I'm playing much of the same games. I just wanted to mention one thing about Yo-Kai Watch 2, where I said it just reuses assets all over the place. I was wrong after 7 hours because it sends you to another town that you have to ride by train. But in the most Japanese thing ever, you have to ride there by train. There is like a train schedule and it asks you at every stop, do you want to get out?
Hi, Shenmue.
And you just watch stuff go by, and occasionally your yokai that you're traveling with and your character will kind of look at each other and maybe have a brief conversation.
Hi, Shenmue.
At one point they talk about, hey, riding the train is so relaxing, to which Jibanyan goes, yeah, the vibration just put me right to sleep. And then Whisper, who's a ghost who doesn't have any, feet, essentially gets depressed because he can't feel them. That's why you have to ride this train. There are warp points in the game. You get them eventually, but there's one train ride that you have to take every time.
So I skipped two, and I've played one and three, Japanese release. And three they put more effort into, but it tanked relative to one and two.
It sure did. Two is a much funnier game than one, and I thought one was funny. And I've been just putting crap on the Miiverse. A lot of times it's not fun. The localizers looked at what they had and they went, oh, all right, how do we fix this? And their answer is basically, I don't know, just don't. Just don't acknowledge how Japanese this shit is. But, you know, by and large, this game is still more Yo-Kai Watch, even though they added these seemingly needless towns and time travel and stuff that just makes it quality of life issues pop up all over the place. And Mark, which is the titular character's default name, has somehow lost both his Yo-Kai Watch upgrades, which means I have to redo that all that crap again, and his bike in the intervening 6 months. It's just gone, so we have to get a new bike, and everything's on foot. So quality of life completely in the tank. So I don't think I'll be finishing this one.
Do you want to buy one of Tom's hot dogs?
No, I don't. It's not Shenmue. That's all I have to say about Yo-Kai Watch 2. This game does not care about your quality of life concerns. Greg.
Yes. Well, speaking of warp points, the game that I'm about to speak about doesn't have any. It's a bit of a tortured segue, but
But it's relevant.
Yes, it is. This is Axiom Verge, so it came out on Wii U a few weeks ago. Got it, kind of worked through it pretty gradually, didn't rush it too much, this kind of game, sometimes it's got a game I could really kind of go at hard, kind of marathon it, but I kind of paced myself with this one, and kind of ended up probably exploring around a little more rather than kind of even at times where I kind of felt like I probably wasn't like on the critical path towards the final boss or whatever, but one of the nice things about this is the fact that you do kind of feel like you get some kind of significant rewards for that. Obviously, you know, in Metroid games, a lot of the times you might find health tanks or missile tanks or whatever that will help. But I guess with Axiom Verge, you've got so many guns in the game. I mean, I got to the final boss with about 90% of the map and 2/3 of the items discovered, and even then it seems like have already had several guns. There's several more I haven't found, and I mean that's the thing, they seem not especially useful, but it is fun to find them and then to piss about with them, basically. And so in a number of cases I kind of just explored around kind of feeling like, yeah, this probably isn't going to be that productive to get to the end of the game quicker, but yeah, finding a weapon and then messing around with it, I personally find that quite fun. It's its own reward to a certain extent rather than just the utility of killing certain enemies or whatever. But I mean they can come in handy for specific situations because they are quite different in their sort of attributes often. To kind of go back to the beginning on this, obviously Axiom Verge is a game that, having heard about it back when it was just exclusive to PS4, you know, about 18 months ago or whatever. It was something that I was really interested in playing, but given the praise that was offered to it, you know, people like Johnny and lots of other reviewers and stuff. I was enthusiastic about playing it, but I guess it can be a problem when you hear about something for like a year and a half. And that it's like, you know, is it going to live up to it in the end? I remember a long time ago, I think it was episode 120, we did a feature about, you know, the role of like expectations of hype and how it ends up affecting, you know, the actual enjoyment you might get out of a game, or indeed even like films and TV or whatever else. It was weird this one because it was exciting for it to be coming to Wii U. Obviously, it was, you know, it could have had it on Xbox or whatever, but I think off TV play with this is a big kind of plus for me, because I think not so much in terms of the like just kind of first time through beat the final boss, which I did like last night. I've done most of that on the TV, which is nice because you have the map right there, the whole map kind of right there on the touchscreen, and you can look at the inventory and stuff like that. So I mean, it, the second screen's useful in that sense, but certainly for this second phase of the game now, where I might go back and see if I can find more of that third of the game's items that I don't have yet, you know, like off TV play is going to be really kind of essential for me, you know, in that capacity for me. You know, now it's going to be hard for it to kind of justify getting the TV time anymore, but I could see myself putting a fair bit more time into this now, to just mop up at least as many of the secrets that I want to find. But, you know, I could have had it earlier, but, you know, it's dragged on this long, and you kind of think, is it really going to kind of live up to it? Because it's got a lot to live up to at this point. You know, I think the sort of the most relevant thing, I tried not to overread about it, because it's one of these games like, well, you know, yes, you had me at hello, I like the sound of this, you know, I'm very eager to play it, you know, so I didn't feel like I needed to read too deeply into it. But there was a piece, I think, on US Gamer that Jeremy Parris did about the notion that this was something that didn't just kind of duplicate Samus's abilities and just give them a different aesthetic, which is kind of what it sounds like Guillaume felt Shadow Cop.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah,
so
you don't have high speed boots, you have zero friction boots.
Yeah,
that's a very different thing,
you know,
when
I mean,
you think about it.
Just the sort of non-union equivalent.
I can't
version
stop.
Is not, yeah, that is not the most exciting thing in the world, though. Yeah, I probably am more of a, like, you know, Metroidvania's like pizza kind of person than Guillaume is, but you know, yeah, that's still not desperately exciting. But what did excite me about what Jeremy Parish was talking about is just the way that, you know, it kind of is obviously so bloody influenced by Metroid and kind of a love letter to it in some ways, but at the same time, you know, manages to put enough of its own spin on it to make it feel like a kind of you know, a fresh, rewarding experience. Because, I mean, it is important, because, I mean, for me, you know, my first Metroid game being Super Metroid and all that, what is so special about that, that obviously any game since has been difficult for it to replicate that exactly, is the sort of the feeling of discovery of how the game works and what the powers are and how the level designs fit together with that and all that stuff. You know, the first time you play one of those games and see that kind of unfold in front of you, I think is pretty special. And like I said, difficult to replicate. But this, well, it couldn't replicate it. I think I felt like, having played it now, legitimately did, you know, a pretty good job of it, compared to other, you know, as the genre has become significantly more kind of popular and certainly just populated with games, indie games in particular, you know, digital games in the years since Shadow Complex came out the first time. You know, this seemed to stand apart from some of the other ones I've played. I mean, aesthetically, I like it. I like the pixel art style. It's kind of interesting. I mean, obviously, yeah, it will remind you of Metroid to a certain extent, but there's the color palette, you know, the very pink and purple, and, you know, also like the way the shading is kind of done actually reminded me a bit of sort of European computer games from back in the day, as much as anything. Not that I have any direct experience with those, but of course the magazines I used to read sort of had screenshots of them, and it just sort of reminded me of those a bit. Certainly has that kind of Giga-esque aesthetic going on, you know, as well, which is kind of appropriate given that, you know, Metroid owes a lot to Alien, and he was the concept artist on that movie. Obviously, they didn't have the detail to really get too similar on the 8-bit original, but there's more of it, I guess, in Super Metroid. But I think the biggest difference for me with Axiom Verge compared to Metroid in terms of atmosphere is that it was more surreal, I think I would say. It's kind of less sort of like, oh, you know, kind of, it is obviously sci-fi and there is a story, and I mean, it didn't do a great deal for me, but more the atmosphere is what I liked, because it had this kind of more dreamlike quality that I think the more overt giga kind of designs and the environments and stuff really kind of call to mind. And then there's overtly trippy kind of segments later in the game, and the whole kind of glitch kind of stuff and all that. It's very sort of video game and sort of meta in that way, but on the other hand, it's got this kind of dreamlike quality to it as well. I think Metroidvania type games are really apt for if you want to get into surrealism, because, you know, the kind of the isolation, the labyrinth, all that kind of thing, it fits for me. I'd like to, I mean, this has a certain amount of dialogue and sci-fi stuff. I think you could pare it back even more and just make it even, you know, really kind of just, you know, opaque, and, you know, kind of like, well, you're almost not really meant to know exactly what's going on. It's just this weird nightmare experience. I'm quite interested in that.
It's the kind of environment that would sort of lend itself also to losing your grip on reality.
Oh
You know, losing other humanity as a yardstick to sort of base yourself on and to continually reaffirm your own existence while also in the unknown is sort of a pitch perfect way to slowly go crazy.
That's the thing. I kind of there's a certain amount of that in Axiom Verge that I enjoyed, you know, as well as a kind of more conventional narrative as kind of alongside it. But that was, yeah, it's neither here nor there. I didn't think it was like bad. It was like dumb, like the way that Kill My Shadow Complex sound. But you know, I kind of like the tone and the style more than the actual content in that area. But you know, in terms of nuts and bolts gameplay stuff, I think the most satisfying part of it was seeing how, you know, you see elements of level design that you instantly get your Metroid brain working, where, you know, you'll see little sort of bits of a wall that's like, well, that's like kind of one tile high that you could sneak in there, so, you know, it looks like a morph ball type of deal. But, you know, is there going to be a morph ball type of thing in this game? What's it going to? And then, you know, you will eventually, of course, get the powers that kind of relate to those parts of the environments, but in such enough of a different way that it kind of feels satisfying. I think there's a real potential in that, actually, where, because you have this kind of remote drone thing that's it sort of serves as kind of the morph ball equivalent, although there are some differences. But the fact that it could kind of go off on its own into these particular areas that you at least initially cannot get to, I think has more potential beyond just the regular kind of Metroid approach. A long time ago, we did a feature about the future of the Metroid series after Corruption came out.
If only we had known.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I remember sort of doing the intro for that and thinking, well, you know, I don't want to be too doom and gloom about this. You know, I mean, all right, the Corruption didn't sell as well as, you know, maybe it could have done, considering the Wii was in its, you know, apex of crazy popularity. But, you know, it's okay. So it's still, you know, did better than like Corruption, the 2 did, or GameCube, whatever. Maybe I'm worrying too much. And then, you know, since then we've had Other M and Federation Force, which I personally enjoyed both those games to a fair extent, but they're not very commercially successful and not very popular with the sort of fan base at large. So yeah, maybe I wasn't anxious enough back then. But one of the things I kind of thought about there was the idea of having maybe a sort of parallel progression path with it. You know, we've got this problem with Metroid where it's always like, well, she's gonna get, you know, certain powers in the game, you know, it's gonna build up to getting the screw attack or whatever, you know, this, you have this same sort of progression the whole time. And maybe, you know, you could offset that a bit by having a familiar progression kind of occurring to some extent, but alongside something a bit more different, you know. And I was thinking, you know, it's kind of, you could do that with the Axiom Verge framework, but where the sort of drone thing gets more powers, essentially, you know, like you were getting more powers, but maybe the places where the drone could only go, you could actually sort of fashion them more as sort of linear type levels, and then give the different powers over time to make those levels kind of progress and develop and become more interesting as the game goes on. I think that'd be a cool way of kind of dealing with the sort of rut that they seem to have got in with Metroid games, if indeed there is any interest in getting out of that day with a more conventional Metroid game than what we've had in the past several years. You know, I think that actually, you know, even though this, you know, to a large extent is, you know, based on Metroid, I think it's showing a glimpse of some kind of potential for expansion there. But on its own terms, I think the powers, you know, hang together really quite well. It feels knitted together very cleverly with the level design, and you feel, you know, there's a certain level, there is that, you know, essential to the genre feeling of empowerment as you gain mastery over the powers and in turn over the environment. I think the only kind of qualms I've got with the game would be for a game which, you know, like, you know, traditional Metroid, does not have warp points, going back to the intro. I think it's imperative that the character's sort of movement and everything feel really sort of fast and good to sort of mitigate the feeling of kind of trudging from one bit to the next, especially if you're just searching out powers and stuff. And I've not got any issues with the controls or whatever, but I wouldn't say this is zero mission either, in terms of like, oh, it's, you know, it's really fast, it's sort of controls like silk kind of thing. It's not that way. It's more old school than that. So, you know, there are times when you're kind of trudging across where it's like, well, and of course, you know, your ability to traverse the environment increases sort of vastly as the game goes on. That's core to the experience. But still, there's parts of the game where, you know, it's like, it might almost discourage exploration. Like some of those times I was talking about where it's like, well, I could think of something that I could try now back in this part of the map, but it's on the other side of the map. And given that I have a hunch it's not that important, do I really want to go and test it? You know, like, so it is, if the character, I don't know, somehow was a bit smoother, you know, a bit faster in its basic movement speed, I think that would have been nice, but then maybe it would have upset the balance in terms of, you know, the combat, you know, facing down the enemies and the bosses and all that. It's tricky to balance all those things at once. I suppose obviously warp points is kind of the quick and dirty solution, but I don't know. I mean, warp points are a big convenience, and I mean, it's something like Castlevania where the level design is not the star of the show, I think they're absolutely essential, because why would you want to just walk through those corridors of enemies over and over again,
right,
if you didn't have to? Well, I mean, there's grinding, but, you know, if you're not grinding, you know. Whereas, yeah, with a true kind of Metroid game, the way the world fits together and finding shortcuts and techniques that make the retraverse a lot faster, that's the core experience for me. So I can understand resisting warp points quite well, but I wouldn't say that the level design is quite there, that it's so good. It's like, oh no, it's fine. Yeah, there are some clever retraversal moments with new powers, but it's not all the way there that it's like, oh, this retraversal is not an issue, because it is. And especially in this phase of the game where I've, you know, beaten the boss and I just want to go all over the map to, you know, seek out the bits I haven't found yet, that is not all that appealing, the thought of kind of trudging around. I mean, there is like one big sector of the map that is basically a subway to make it quicker to get across the, you know, from one side of the world to the other, except you ride a giant giga head instead of a train. But, you know, I mean, that helps, but, you know, still, yeah, there's not. I wouldn't say the layout is quite. I think, yeah, some of the ways that Zero Mission ends up joining up the areas once you've got access to all the powers, you know, the power bomb included and all that, is I feel like it's more, you know, that really kind of makes that tick on that level in a way that I can't see this doing. But I will say, you know, it's certainly a significantly more challenging game than Zero Mission on normal, which wouldn't be difficult, of course, because it's famously easy. You know, and so in that sense, just getting to the final boss and beating it was kind of more of a challenge and kind of a bit more rewarding for it. I thought it was pretty well balanced in that regard, you know, as a sort of action game. The boss design was not like anything amazing or incredibly clever, but they were always fun to look at. Super happy music for some reason, but it's kind of a change of pace because it's very moody the rest of the time, and I must say very effective. Music is excellent, kind of helped reinforce that whole surreal vibe that I was talking about earlier on. I very much enjoyed that. You know, obviously, yeah, you got some of the kind of chiptune stuff that you'd expect with a game that looks the way this does with the pixel art, but it's there's more to it than that. It's really good music. So I really thoroughly did enjoy this. It had a lot of weight of expectations on it, but broadly speaking, it lived up to it. And it's always a pleasure to sink my teeth into one of these kinds of games when they really do hit the right notes like this. So I'm sure everybody's, you know, they didn't need me to think about getting it anyway. But, you know, I mean, add myself to the chorus of people like Zach in his review that thought it's a really, really wonderful game.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for new business this week. When we come back, it will be time for listener mail. We're back with listener mail. You can send us your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Seren has the first email.
Capsule J writes, "Dear RFN crew, I've been noticing a trend lately of game series that have traditionally been known for having great pixel art switching to a polygonal 2.5D style. King of Fighters, Shantae, and Castlevania/Bloodstained come to mind. Do you guys know if this is done purely for artistic reasons, or if there's a technical or financial reason for making the change? Thanks, as always, for putting on a great podcast."
So the SNK one is the one that hurt me most deeply, because SNK was notorious for their amazingly detailed sprite work that had beautiful fluid animation and just looked go look at like Garou Mark of the Wolves. It still looks amazing. And of course, that's why they made this move.
It is, first, it's a lot more expensive to make 2D sprite art.
Yeah, well, I would
heavily,
assume
heavily
it depends.
Animated 2D
heavily
sprite
animated
art.
Right, yeah.
Sprite.
Yeah, it depends on the level of detail. Like, mm-hmm. Something has got to give at some point, right? Like, it's like the Batman animated series was very minimalistic in style, but it was super well animated. And then you switch to Spider-Man, which was very detailed and had like 2 frames per second.
King of Fighters 14, specifically, is the one he's referring to. Is there is such a large cast of characters, and there are so many attacks and animations, that game would have had probably needed to have twice the budget. And Atlus was funding SNK on that one, and Atlus ain't rich. Even with Sega's money, Sega ain't rich either. Yeah, so King of Fighters, I almost guarantee, was budgetary. But also, when we're in 2016 and you're hiring on for a new project, which, especially for a AAA studio, or a AA for
which
someone
SNK
like...
Ate.
Yeah, or AA for SNK. When you're hiring on for a new project, it is a lot more common these days to find people who can rig a 3D and animate a 3D model than hand draw all of like cells upon cells upon cells upon cells of fluid and beautiful animation for every single 2D animated sprite in the game.
Right. So to give a little bit of background here, why I say it's more difficult, and to a certain degree, I imagine most people can kind of intuit why this is. For a 3D model, essentially, you build out the model and you put all your detail and your design and your skin over. You build your skeleton, then you put your detail uh-huh. layers on it. You build up on the model, and then you finally put, you know, all your skin, fabric, all that kind of stuff. And those things have physics on them. They have, you know, points of articulation. They have movement ranges, just like your actual body does. Like, you can't twist your arm in certain ways. And the model, if it's properly rigged, which is the term they use for this kind of stuff, won't do it either. But that means when you animate them, you can essentially say, I want the arm, when this animation happens, I want it to go from here to here. And you can let the computer create the spots in between.
Mm-hmm.
When you hand animate sprites, there's no computer involved. You're actually drawing a piece of art. And that means you need to draw all the steps between point A and point B. Animated TV shows do this by farming out work to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But that's expensive. And King of Fighters is a great example here because King of Fighters is actually a mashup game. It takes in characters from lots of different SNK fighting games and threw them into one sort of like, look at all of our cool brands. And so it always had a huge cast. But a lot of times it was reusing stuff from other games, or it was picking up art assets from, say, what was Samurai Showdown didn't really show up in King of Fighters that much.
No. Mark of the Wolves?
Yeah, Mark of the Wolves, which now has had two references in a row. they would show up and they would be, you know, essentially not the same. Like, Terry might get recolored a little bit. But there was a lot of opportunity for reuse, but they also had really good artists and really involved and detailed and like they built the Neo Geo platform because they knew they were good at this kind of art.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing as well. It's that the expertise had kind
Fatal
of
Fury.
Grown up around go. That as well, because, you know, that's what the market was back then. Yeah, you know, that
right.
was the Neo Geo, the arcade games. They came up before DKC, for instance, which kind of gave us another way to create sprites and to animate things, where, you know, you create a model and then make the sprites based on that model. So you kind of, you know, you end up with sprite work, you know, but essentially, you know, it's made in a computer first. And I mean, that as, you know, for while that was, you know, touted as high tech and progressive and next gen back in the mid 90s, you know, latterly it became the cheap way to do things. People complained about the Fire Emblem games on DS going to pre-rendered sprites rather
Mario
than
Mario versus DK.
Yeah, rather than the hand-drawn style, you know, the hand-animated kind of style that you'd had before. And again, yeah, you would assume that was a cost-saving measure. It was just a lot easier to right. do it that way. So I think budget definitely has, you know, a role to play. I mean, the Shantae example is interesting because you want to talk about expertise in this area. WayForward have it. They know what they're doing. They've got the expertise with pixel art, obviously, literally in the Shantae series already. You know, the most recent one, 3DS Pirates Curse, before Half Genie Hero, which is the one that he's referred to in terms of the change. That's got beautiful pixel art, and so does Mighty Switch Force and all sorts of things they've done over the years. So in that case, would you, Seren, have a guess about exactly what is underpinning that particular decision? Because it's certainly not for a lack of, you know, knowledge.
No, I'm pretty sure that Shantae Half Genie Hero specifically is a hybrid of polygonal environments and vector 2D animated sprites. So it's not pixel art. I didn't think that the characters actually, I think they have faux depth, but like,
right.
I don't think they actually are 3D models. I think it is still hand animated, the character, especially protagonist, maybe not all of the NPCs, maybe the NPCs sometimes cheat, but like, I know the environments are all 3D, and
yeah,
I know that the, when this game, especially when on Kickstarter, they were trying to pitch this as the made for HD Shantae. Whereas Shantae originally obviously was a Game Boy Color game, removed from the conversation, and then Risky's Revenge was a DSiWare game, but Pirate's Curse's lead platform was 3DS, and so, especially when you're working at a base resolution of 400 by 240, it's a lot easier to prioritize and hand animate pixels when your character is 20 pixels tall.
Right.
But when you're working in
a 1080 game,
1920 by 1080, no.
Yeah, like no, I mean, they do have, I mean, like, a Boy and His Blob is another thing that they've done in the past where you're talking about a hand-drawn 2D style, you're not a pixel art style, but it's still, you know, it's not polygonal, and that looked fantastic. I mean, they've done it a whole bunch of different ways. So, I would imagine that took a lot of care. To produce stuff like that. But, I wonder, to some extent, do you think there's any kind of attempt to kind of escape maybe a certain perception around pixel art games? Like maybe, you know, people don't think they're as worth as much money if they look that way. People think they look cheap, even if ironically, in some ways, you know, they might actually be more expensive, or it reminds them of old stuff or stuff on mobile. I mean, any sort of feelings on that it might be a perception issue?
Well, the funny thing is that both of the games we talked about here, King of Fighters and Shantae, are heavily selling in their trade of being retro-ish. Shantae weirdly has become this nostalgic game, even though it was kind of an also-ran Game Boy Color game that
just very quite light, you know, Game Boy.
Right,
you know,
it then turned into this big sprawling series in the last 5 years. But in the case of King of Fighters, like I said, it's a compilation game of the litany of SNK fighting games from, say, 1991 to 2001, where they were just pumping them out at a incredible clip. I think actually Guilty Gear Xrd, which came out relatively recently. Xrd was 2014, I think.
2014 with an updated version. That was Xrd Sign. Xrd Revelator was this year.
Right. So the Guilty Gear series was also a sprite work. Those are done by Arc Systems, right?
This is the best example of this. I can't believe I didn't think of this.
But they actually went and built an engine that has the sprite look, but it's not.
It's unreal.
Yeah, it's not actually sprite, but it looks like sprite art. It is an unbelievable labor of love they took, because they had to make that migration. Because they had the same problem, you know. Guilty Gear started out on the PlayStation, I think, and it was really easy to go ahead and.
The way that Guilty Gear Xrd looks is, it looks like a 2D arcade fighting game where the characters sort of jump between animation frames so you can count the frames, but then as soon as you go into a special, the camera pans and you realize you were staring at a 3D model the whole time and didn't realize it. And it is the craziest thing, because it looks like a gorgeously realized 3D model, and then when it pans back to the perfect 2D plane, it literally looks like a very high resolution Street Fighter II style animation sprite.
I mean, it looks like something they could do for a TV show. A lot like there's one of the kind of hallmarks of SNK's sprite work, especially some of Capcom stuff. You know, Capcom and SNK in the early to mid '90s were sort of rivals. No, they were explicitly rivals.
Oh,
in
yeah,
this field.
Yeah.
Like to the point of mocking each other.
Games
yeah,
ruled the world. Like that was right. Such a huge deal.
And like they would create characters mocking each other's characters. At some point, they had the contract where you had Capcom versus SNK and then CVS Clash or whatever that game was called. But one of the things that came out of this rivalry were things like ruffling fabrics on sprites, which meant that each of those was an independent frame of animation.
The arms race of that kind of sprite. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that kind of expertise was built up, you know, in the sort of crucible of that time, where those were some of the biggest games in the industry, and you had different companies competing with each other to get an edge. And of course, you know, as well as the jump to HD and all that, you know, loads of different facts, but you don't really have that anymore. It's not like this huge money in like making that kind of style.
And if I think it's, I don't know if Capsule J is not convinced that 2D, hand-drawn animation is more costly. Like, just think about, like, if you want to change something on a model, you have to change it on every single frame of animation afterwards. And it's just, it becomes kind of a nightmare, right? So if you've got the 3D model where you put the skin over it, then it becomes easier to make that one, you know, cosmetic change and keep the work you've done on the animation. And you can also, you know, like, it's simpler to add new skins, new costumes. There's less work involved. Mm-hmm. You don't have to redraw everything.
Sure, and you wanted to say something?
Yeah, if you, next time you look at a relatively high budget game that has explicit hand-drawn animation, when the credits come up, look for the job in between checker.
Oh, God. Mm.
Because that is the person who stares at every frame possible. It's even like the ones that the computer tries to blur between drawn frames and makes sure that they're all up to a certain quality. This happens especially in 2D animated TV shows, let me tell you. Because they don't sit there and draw, especially in animated TV shows, 24 frames every second. They draw maybe 12 and let the computer create the other 12. But then someone gets to sit there and look at every single picture.
And if you go back and watch really old Simpsons episodes, before the computer could do that, and they really had to farm out 24 frames to a Korean labor farm, you'll see times where like frames just go weird colors. And the reason is, like, a cell got in there that wasn't finished, or the animator was tired after drawing Bart's face for 10 hours. Or something happened, and, like, it blinks for a second, and because of the schedule that show was being made on in the early days of Fox, where Fox was like, get another season on the air, this and Married with Children are all we have, there was essentially quality control got left out. And you can see, like, the frames and how much work it went for that. And that's why, as a parallel, in the mid-ish, maybe even early-ish 2000s, you saw this run of TV cartoons that looked very similar because they were all being built in Flash Animation Studio. Because that was way cheaper. Because to Guillaume's point, if you wanted to make a change, you still had to do the frames. Because Flash doesn't do as much animation between for you, although it can. But everything had layers. So you would just go to each frame and just change that one layer and continue on your way. So all these cartoons had this very Flash-looking style, and the reason they looked like Flash animations is that's what they were. Like, this was Flash animation taken to its most extreme, but it's the same reason. It was way cheaper, and you could turn it around without having to send your animation outlines to another continent to be outsourced.
Mm-hmm.
So is Wario Land Shake It on the Wii U Virtual Console? I feel it should be.
I think it is, isn't it?
It is in some regions, not North America.
Some regions?
Oh, come on. Oh, that's a shame.
So that's just a beautiful game.
Oh, yeah.
2D animation, and it's just...
Good feel. And think about that. Good feel hasn't made a hand-drawn game in a while.
No, because, the yarn aesthetic has supplanted Wario Land, but that and Boy and His Blob. Two of the best looking games on Wii. But...
And in fact, Disney, the holdouts on hand-drawn animation have really moved away from it too. Like, their movies are CG now because CG is weirdly more affordable.
And Wario Land Shake It and games like it emphasize their strong art style and animation style with strong keyframes. But if you want a solid, smooth, draw like animated 2D, no 3D game. Oh my gosh. Especially in today's resolutions, you need budgets that are not feasible.
Which is not, yeah, not economic in the market. That's a, yeah.
Even something like Wario, there's a relatively limited number of animation frames too. Whereas in a fighting game, you've got 20 characters with, let's say, 15 to 20 moves each that can be executed at different heights, that can be interrupted. There's frame interruptions, you know, there's cancels. All of those scenarios need to be animated, and it's insane.
I think King of Fighters 14 has 46 characters.
Yeah, it's a stupid number. And they're all crazy, and it is what it is. But I think we sort of covered
Yeah,
it.
I think we've discovered the best way to drive Sakurai utterly mad is to insist on hand-drawn animation for the next Smash Bros.
Have you ever hand-drawn a game?
Yes.
All right. So, yeah, well, yes. Next email. Yo.
Jordan writes, "Hey guys, there have been rumors about a Final Fantasy VI remake slash reboot for NX. If that turns out to be true, what would you want it to be? How could they improve on the original? Is this even possible? In such a way as to appease old fans and introduce the game to new ones. Cheers."
So I did a lot of work to try to run this rumor down in response to this email, and I can't. That doesn't necessarily mean
I haven't
it's
heard it.
not it's not legit. I'd heard it, but I couldn't figure out where I had heard it from, and I've saw some places talking about it.
Reddit.
I don't necessarily. So I'm more or less going to say let's treat this email as if it's a hypothetical.
Yeah, and I mean it's just I guess it's just the tradition of them remaking, you know, kind of weird that they stopped, you know, after four. I know there's seven, but I'm on about in the numerical sequence. You know, they were remaking the games. They did three, they did four,
They
but
did
then
six.
they did do six.
They did
It
do
was not
six.
bad
Oh
for
my
mobile.
God. Can I
Yeah,
talk about the six remake?
briefly, very
Because
briefly.
six is one of my favorite games of all time.
What is this, on mobile or
On mobile
PC?
and Steam. So
Yes.
Oh, that's right, they put out on PC, yes.
So four and five and three, four, like all the DS remakes are on Steam. All the console remakes are on Steam. Steam got the phone version of six, and they people tore it apart. The PC and phone remake of six is the GBA ROM, so all of the code feeding into Flash animation.
Speaking of that animation stuff again.
But they changed all the text, and now there's a bunch of typos. It's not better localization or translation, they just added typos. For like
They're gonna
espers
do a
are now
typo filter.
espheres.
Spears, yeah. That
And
literally shows up in the first like screen of text,
yes,
basically.
and there's horrible, horrible UI everywhere, but like the core game is literally there's just a GBA ROM in the source code.
Beautiful.
So that's a port. That's not a remake.
I don't even want to call that a port.
Yeah, that's being
It is
charitable, yeah.
a remake in that the entire visual system is different and worse.
Yes. So I don't know why the word reboot is in there.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I look at what we suspect is going to happen with Final Fantasy VII, and you could call it a remake, but in a lot of but
They are.
depending on how crazy they go, like that may not even be a remake anymore.
They're
That may
changing the
be,
story.
yeah, that may just be a whole different thing.
It is. It is.
So remake probably isn't the right word there. Retelling, you know,
Yeah,
we have the, you know, the issue.
reimagined, I think is Tim
Yes.
Burton's term for
In
it, isn't it?
film, we have the term the reboot and the soft reboot, where like Ghostbusters is a reboot, but The Force Awakens is a soft reboot, where one just sort of is like, all right, everything's being reset, and the other one is, well, you know, it is what it is. It does exist. The question is,
So
in a video game
is it
sense,
soft remake? Is that a
right?
term?
Yeah,
Yeah,
or is it
because
just a
it's.
hard remake where it's just like, no, nothing is sacred. The basic plot outline is the same, but beyond that.
Yeah, it's so putting Final Fantasy VII Remake, which is the name of the project, aside for a second, what would you even want other than higher resolution and available on modern platforms?
I would actually like to see them envision that world outside of, you know, Super Nintendo style sprite work, even at a higher resolution. Because I mean, I've played Super Nintendo games at higher resolution in the PlayStation era. I would like to see that world rendered in three dimensions.
That game was on PS1. It was the SNES version with extremely long load times.
Yeah. No. What I mean is we've seen you know, Super Nintendo style games.
That are higher res. But I mean, I know you kind of. I think that would be what a lot of people are hoping for from the FF7 remake. In terms of seeing that story come to life in a more kind of vibrant way, and arguably, you know, that's perhaps more of a sort of driving motivation with FF6, because it was still in the 2D kind of no CD CG cutscene era of Final Fantasy, so there's actually more heavy lifting to do there. Not that storytelling hasn't come quite a way since Final Fantasy VII first came out.
Storytelling had come quite a way before Final Fantasy VII.
Seven is a lesser version of six at some point. The character archetypes are similar. Very close to identical. The combat system is the same, but less complicated in 7 than it was in 6.
Seven takes that step towards steampunk sci-fi, though, and that's sort of the
six
pivot
is
point.
Steampunk
for
sci-fi.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, they're walking around in mechs at the start and Nosh and all that.
It's steampunk sci-fi.
Yeah, the whole castle just buries in the sand.
Let me rephrase it. It steps away from any of the pretense of like fantasy stuff. It's like all of that's gone. You know, there's no wizards and shit. All of this is out. We're going into just like, oh, how did you get your powers? Oh, genetic manipulation. Oh, okay, thanks. Like they moved into this more 90s motif of shit that gave us like the Matrix, where it's like, oh no, these are super weapons born through genetic engineering in a tube from space meteors. Like, you know, it is what it is.
Have you guys played either of the FF3 or FF4 DS remakes?
I played the FF4 remake on DS, yeah.
So
I played some of 3, but it's not very good. So.
No, I mean, 3 is not a very good game, but it's a good remake of a subpar game.
Sure.
The chibi polygonal art style, I feel they accidentally stumbled on the best possible art style, and I think that's why they may have kept it for the PC version, because if you've ever played, like, the Dissidia games, it's really weird. It's not bad, but it's a little strange to see the characters in full, like, Final Fantasy XIII style.
Mm.
But, and so...
Yeah, I did get the idea of Kefka... Like, yeah, looking like an actual
that's
person.
That's what he is in Dissidia.
It doesn't really work for me.
But that game has so many environments and so many complex cinematography, even for the Super Nintendo, that I don't think, especially because 6, while I think it's a better game, was obviously dwarfed by 7, and it never came out in Europe originally.
Yeah, I mean, there's a success difference
here. Yes, there's a huge success.
Name recognition.
And so I don't think they can give it a full HD modern graphics treatment.
Yeah, they look at it, but never would blow as much money as I assume they're blowing on 7.
Oh, they are burning money in the back of the building for Final Fantasy 7.
But then you turn around and you say, well, would people be okay with the FF3, FF4 graphic art style, which was pushing the DS on a more modern system than the DS?
I think you'd have to go 3 or 4 steps beyond that at a minimum.
What about, like, sort of the Bravely games as a benchmark? Obviously, aesthetically, they could be different in terms of, you know, the character design and all that, but in terms of the level of, you know, graphic kind of fidelity that you got there, presumably this would be on a subsequent system, so it wouldn't be as low res. But,
I mean, the thing about the Bravely games, though, is that, you know, I accept them for what they are graphically, and they do have... I would say the only characters that look all cheapified are your party.
The yeah
Oh yeah,
the
like everybody's like 20 feet tall. It must be like, you know, like Idia's dad is. How is that even physically possible?
He's 30 feet tall. It's
That
absurd.
game
And
has great art direction in its environments, but the thing about remaking a game is you already have the environments designed. Like, you can change the art direction, but the environment design is done unless you're going to stray. And I don't want to speak for too many people, but I feel like Seven has more fans, but Six's fans are more passionate about that game being faithful, like any version of that being faithful. And so I'm not sure how much they would want to divert from Six. Like, I don't know. It's.
I think, wait, I think he was saying is if there was a remake, maybe it would be more of a conservative kind of remake than you know, some maybe what Seven's gonna be or something like that. I mean, I could see, I could see, it is strange to me. I mean, just see what, you know, they put them all out on, you know, they put Final Fantasy games on WonderSwan. They put then they started putting them out on GBA. Then they started remaking them on the DS. It's kind of weird that that chain got broken, considering that continue, you know, that handheld market continues to be the, you know, the bread and butter of games in Japan outside of mobile, of course. You know, and you know, you would have thought that, of course, yeah, mobile ports are one thing, but you know, if you could do DQ7, DQ8 on one side of the company, you know, it's still a little surprising to me
Heck,
that they
they remade the Saga games, like for, you know, on Game Boy. They remade the Final Fantasy Legend games. We never got them here because the DS was kind of decimated by piracy, but
I mean, you look at the DS remakes of 3, 4, 5, and the sales, especially of 5, were very negligible, and that coincided with the App Store becoming the predominant game distribution platform in Japan. And I think that's why you saw the 6 remake on phones instead of DS. And then I think you saw Square Enix, at their current leadership at the time, say, we can put a little less effort into this because it's not a dedicated device. And then some marketer said $22.
yeah.
that just doesn't really seem to fit together very well.
Square Enix's mobile strategy is schizophrenic at best.
Final
When they
Fantasy
develop.
VII, the whole PS1 game in PS1 graphics is on there for $19.99.
When they develop a new game for mobile with mobile in mind, they seem to do okay. But when they try to leverage an existing game, they just seem to fuck it up. And I don't entirely know why. And maybe when something that's built from the ground up for mobile, it goes through a different management structure, and those people get it versus their core management structure. Who's just, like, is Wada still in charge there? And his team, who come from a more traditional game place, who are like, no, games sell at $19 or more. That's the price. Put it on the App Store.
The world ends with you, $20 for iPhone, $21 for iPad, and you can't cross-buy. It's like
Great.
the only one of the only apps that
Or
the iOS,
$9 on Amazon.
the iPhone version doesn't work on your iPad.
So yeah, I wonder if the management structure that's in charge of these old games being put into mobile just doesn't get the economics of that platform. And one thing I did want to talk about beyond just like my desires for a Final Fantasy VI remake, because FF6 for me isn't the RPG I hold in reverence. And I've talked about how I really respect the Final Fantasy games of Super Nintendo, but I hold a lot of the what would be considered also ran Super Nintendo RPG series closer to my heart.
Lufia 2.
Lufia 2 is amazing. Lufia 1 is good. Lufia 2 remake can bite me.
This is what you could run into trouble if
You
you
could.
say they made it like actiony or
That's right.
whatever.
They can make an action game and then demo it at E3, where everybody is level 99 but has level 1 weapons, and you can't kill anybody and they can't kill you. But what I would, from an economic standpoint, you know, the idea of an NX rumored port, the only way I would it would make sense, really speaking, is Square Enix, more than most publishers, but really this applies to the slate of Japanese publishers, has a vested interest in a at least two domestic console manufacturers being stable. Because they don't want to get in a situation where they've got one tyrant at home.
Mm-hmm.
They'd like to have at least one person to play off of. And there's two ways to do that. There's one, make sure your games are on everything. Or two, make sure your games are split up in such a way that your most hardcore consumers will be on both. And that way you can say, well, we're going to take this game to so-and-so, and unless you want to talk money. And that's where I could see them saying, well, maybe Final Fantasy VI makes a lot more sense on a Nintendo platform because people who have reverence for Nintendo still probably have it from back then and would associate this with their Super Nintendo. Final Fantasy VII, they'd associate with their PlayStation. But again, with these big remakes, the economics are like, I need to get this onto anybody who can give me money any way possible. So there is a weird dichotomy of building something exclusively for NX unless other factors beyond economics
and of course it begs the question, the old siren question about, you know, right, what it is and you know how it could, you know, relative to, you know, a big FF7 type of remake, you know, would it fall naturally fall closer to, you know, something like the DQ7 remake that
right,
just came out here. Where, you know, you're doing a fair bit with it, you know, you're making it a lot prettier and all this kind of stuff, but it's not got these humongous kind of cinematic ambitions and all that kind of stuff.
Right. You know, working within the confines of the system you have, but also working within the concept of, if I'm going to spend, you know, $50, $60 million developing this game and then $30, $40 million marketing it, I need to sell this to every human being who owns a system that plays video games, regardless of what they're playing it on.
And that is why Kingdom Hearts 3 is on Xbox One, despite no other game in that entire series ever being on a Microsoft platform.
Right. It just costs too damn much to make.
Yeah, you got to amortize the cost. It's just, yeah.
Some sucker will buy it.
We talk about, like, the numbers that Final Fantasy 15 has to move to be profitable.
Oh, no.
And it what was it, like, what was the number?
It needs to make about $100 million of revenue to be written off at zero.
Right, and that probably, and when they throw in the marketing, I don't believe that number. I bet that number is not even close.
They bought the city of Los Angeles to advertise across the entire city during E3 and then change the date that they advertised on the city of Los Angeles.
You know, I mean, the most recent delay, I just thought it was kind of cute. It's like, oh, one more for old time's sake. But when you put it in that context, that is a monstrous fuck up, actually.
They had banners across all of downtown Los Angeles, not just the convention center.
So I kind of wonder, like, where does Square Enix's money even come from? Like, between this and Lara Croft, but Tomb Raider didn't sell on Xbox One.
It did not. The last Tomb Raider game was not very successful, but they got paid a shit ton of money by Microsoft to have it be exclusive.
Yes, Microsoft paid for the exclusivity, and then Sony paid for them to bring it to PlayStation 4 with virtual reality.
So the answer is deals, hot deals.
Mm.
But, you know, they probably made money from Nintendo to get the Dragon Quest 7 and Dragon Quest 8 ports. Yeah. I mean, Square Enix is to quote John Lindemann, doing business. They make money on their brand more than anything. And that's a dangerous game to be playing. And, of course, you could apply the same conversation to Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, saying we're going to cash in on our brand and the loyalty people have for us. But in the medium term, it does allow them to have this. If there's two successful partners, we can continue to play this game because we can keep cashing in checks from one and the other.
Mm-hmm.
If there's only one platform, Sony ain't going to give you a check for exclusive games because guess what? Yeah. You're going to pay us to put your game on the platform.
And here's how Square Enix makes their money on games that they don't have deals. Let me introduce you to microtransactions and $60 games.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the economics of being AAA development is really, really crappy right now. And there was an article just the other day about it, about how essentially the reason why we're seeing not just microtransactions, but like single-use microtransactions show up so pervasively, even in things like sports games, is because it's the only way the economics really makes sense at this point. With and we've harped on the increase in budget for when games go to HD, and in fact, it applies to the last question too. It applies even more so as you can squeeze more and more textures and art and complex character models, complex animation, more character models on screen, more detail into these games on these systems. The cost invariably skyrockets.
Well, if they can just keep from having like Chris Pratt voice Saban or something.
Like, no, you're right. But
that,
you know,
would help. That would go a long way.
A lot of times that might not be the big deal because that's probably just some rider in a contract somewhere. Versus, I mean, I don't know how much it costs to get Pratt to give you, you know, 3 afternoons of voice recording, but it's probably nothing compared to the marketing budget of buying all the bulletin boards in Los Angeles during E3.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, you want to look at, there are two sides to this. There's gamers who, especially if you go read the comments on PlayStation blog on literally any post, don't understand why games can't look the best as, why every game can't look like an Uncharted 4. And, like, they don't understand because they're like, well, the system can do this. Everyone else is lazy because average consumer doesn't piece that together. And then the other side is, let's take a brief glimpse at Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, where you have, like, great game. You have an auteur like Kojima who, first of all, that game had an $80 million budget and
built his own damn engine.
Built his own engine and then decided to kick out the voice actor, the English language voice actor for Snake, because he saw some 24 and said, I'll have some of that. And like, also, not only did they pay, I think, like 2 to 3 times as much for the voice acting, there's only like 2 hours of dialogue of Snake in that game. Because Kiefer Sutherland is really expensive.
Limited what they could do in the game, probably because of his need to have
Kiefer Sutherland managed to do with no editor.
No one else could. He edited Kojima, de facto editor.
It wasn't just the only voice Solid Snake has ever had in the English language. And he had been doing the role so long, he was helping co-write the English dialogue.
And
to be fair, though, this is, you know, I mean, this is a game that just, like, you know, a series rather, just nakedly appropriated movie imagery earlier. You know, I mean, that's who Kojima is. That's who he's always been. It's like, I see stuff, I want to appropriate it. Like, that.
He had become the character. Like, but it's.
James.
There's some shit here.
Ever since after Metal Gear Solid 1, Kojima made David Hayter re-audition every single game in hopes that they could find a better Hollywood talent.
I gotta wonder, like, you know, how did they never give Kurt Russell enough money? I mean, surely that was the dream guy, right? I mean,
right. I'm sure it was.
But all the cutscenes in Phantom Pain just end with staring at Snake's face.
Because he was never recorded to close it. Well, I mean, I think the thing was, Kurt Russell, you know, he was, rest in peace, was only picked the best scripts, and he read that and said, no, this is beneath me.
Psycho.
He's been on a comeback lately.
I don't remember.
What do you want out of an FF6 remake?
A lot of people
would want it to be extant. Are they?
Don't get the original David Hayter to play Terra, accept that.
I want Finnish voice acting only.
I mean, that is a legitimate issue though. To pretty, you know, because voice acting would probably, you know, that they brought that in with the FF4 remake, for instance, that I played. And you wonder how people respond to that when it's something that they really cherish, because you get into the area of, like, with novel adaptations where, you know, people might have kind of a voice, you know, in their own imagination that they had for the character, and you know, the voice actor that ultimately delivers those lines might totally be nowhere near that for a lot of people. You know, I mean, that might spoil the experience. But on the other hand, you know, the joy of these sorts of things, I would have thought, is hearing and seeing it come to life in a way that it hasn't existed before. So it's that's tough in terms of, you know, how do you kind of give people, you know what you think they want, even though it's almost inevitable that you will piss off
especially a character like Kefka, who obviously will be voiced by Emo Phillips, like
Danny DeVito.
Does it need voice acting? I guess it depends on what it is. If they go all out on it, you have to voice act.
But like I say, even you know, like sort of like FF4, which is not, you know, like crazy. Obviously, it's still using like chibi models to do the cutscenes and stuff in engine, but it has voice acting. So, but
it has FMV cutscenes.
Full of voice acting.
Yes, it does have FMV cutscenes, which don't actually match the aesthetic at all.
No, it looks like Final Fantasy 13 style.
It's totally incongruous, which is another just a weird decision. Yeah,
that's a Square thing though. That started a decade or
yeah. I mean,
then.
Even the Bravely games have got a bit of that going on. It's not as
a
extreme,
bit.
but
back to Final Fantasy 7, where there's three different ways to portray the characters, and like it's just complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean. Right, I think to point this, it's a minefield to do this. I would be curious to go even back to the very beginning, how this rumor originated versus just somebody spitballing.
Just because it's sort of plausible, basically. Right. You know,
it's got that ring of truth that makes it stick.
Because
like,
Square Enix
can't
shut up about it.
Seven, they never did six. Maybe this is the time to do six and X. Both of them have X in it.
Square Enix also never shutting up about the platform.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have been quite loquacious about it compared to most.
Ubisoft hasn't announced more than one game for it. They just keep talking about the platform. Square Enix announced a game and then had to backtrack.
Yeah. I mean, and Square Enix has said that they're interested in remaking more of these games. Mm-hmm. And obviously, because much like when you remake a movie or you make a TV show, when you remake a game, a lot of your work is done for you.
Yep. The only non-remade Final Fantasies are 6, if you don't count the mobile version, which I don't.
Right, like a real proper remake.
6, 8, 9, 11, and then the 13 games.
I bet 9 is coming. Not 9 feels like one that they could pull off and sell as nostalgia now. And
yeah,
and
that
might never happen.
Nostalgic at the time, right? Like that was the one that was like,
yeah,
okay,
that's why you can get away with it.
This is harkening back to the pre-7 era. Yeah, so I guess it could work as a sort of compound nostalgia product.
There was an episode where we talked about being nostalgic for a nostalgic remake.
Yeah,
I can't remember what game it was, but. There you go.
That's compound nostalgia. That's what we'll call it from now.
So if we ever feel nostalgia for Bravely Default, there you go. We'll have reached the triple tier nostalgia, and then we'll have to shut the show down. Like we do now, because that is the end of email this week. We only had two because we went a little long.
Just I never did say what I wanted.
Guillaume. You know what? What do you want?
Well, now that we've mentioned all this kind of like what a star-studded cast that it could have, I think that the opening with the exoskeletons should be directed by Guillermo del Toro.
Sold.
And I will settle for nothing less.
Sold. Give the man a blank check.
I'll see what Rinko Kikuchi's up to and see if she can get in there and voice some character while you get your friggin' mech porn going. All right. Mech porn is now another name for this episode. Oh, that's good to do it for email this week. You can send us your email or your weird castings for Final Fantasy VI Remake that doesn't currently exist to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We've got some plugs to do. As I mentioned at the start of the show, next Saturday, October 15th, 2016, we will be doing the telethon in support of Child's Play. This is the 7th one. by the time you hear the show, I hope to God we'll have the donation link. Hey, please send me my donation link so we can get that up there. You can start contributing. It is $4,000 target this year. We gave a little step down just because we wanted to make sure we got through all 13 and a half hours. We will be starting at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time. You can probably pretty safely miss that. It's mostly going to be mic checks and laying out the show. But we, Radio Free Nintendo, will be going live at 12 noon Eastern time to give a retrospective on the Wii U as led by our friend Greg.
Yep, the Wii Eulogy. We're sticking with that name now.
It's so dark.
Yeah, well, it's appropriate, as we said, as the aforementioned Color Splash basically kind of closes the door on exclusives.
Here's your Wii U game for the rest of the system.
Yeah, for the rest of eternity. I mean, there's non-exclusive games.
There are non-exclusive games.
Yeah, Ukulele, to look forward to, for instance. I'm sure Bloodstained will still come in 2018. That's pretty much nailed on.
Breath of the Wild.
Yeah,
as a non-exclusive.
Breath of the Wild, as a non-exclusive, okay. That's a huge deal. But yeah, the exclusive sort of phase of Nintendo provided for Wii U, its software library is over, basically. So seems like as good a time as any to look back at what the software library became over this not even 4 years and how it stacks up in the history of Nintendo platforms.
Right. Also, the subsequent week, we will be doing our retroactive on LEGO City Undercover for Wii U. Again, after we have done the Wii Eulogy.
Yeah, that's why it's officially there. Retro after we do the Wii Eulogy.
But 3DS isn't the system that we
had before. Oh, yeah, the 3DS spin-off game is in no way retro.
Oh, no, that game, don't even talk about that. I gave that a 2.5 out of 10.
Additionally, Seren will be doing a segment we talked about at the beginning with the game pitch.
Pitch me your ideas and I'll crush your hopes and dreams.
She said, not me. But we have a whole full lineup to go. It is now currently, regardless of if the donation link is available, it is currently viewable on NintendoWorldReport.com. We hope you will be able to join us. If you can't, is Child's Play Charity is a good cause that gives or that buys toys and games for children who are either in hospital or in shelters, who are going through relatively tough stuff in their life, and gives them something to enjoy and take their mind off what they're going through. So we've been doing this for 7 years. We've raised, I want to say, over $20,000. I don't have the number on me at this point. And we enjoy doing it. It's a good cause and it's a good time. If you can't make it, you'll be able to donate before or after the show, and we will have the show broken up into manageable chunks on the RFN feed over the course of the subsequent week. Usually about 3 hour chunks. Scram, what else do you have to plug?
Speaking of games that cost too much money because they're hand animated, still working on Monochrono. I'm still in a very slow debate with Apple over what is considered acceptable content in an app for an app update to Monochrono Prologue that I've been fighting for 2 months.
Perfect.
They seem to think that the book category of their app store doesn't fall under the category of book. So, miscommunication there. And I am working still on My Real Arcade, formerly codenamed Platform Arcade VR, exclusively for PlayStation VR, first half of 2017.
Yeah, just tell them Mario's in it, you'll be fine.
No.
They don't seem to care. All right, on that, it's time for us to go. Bye, everybody.
You got to cue up music, James.
Oh, God damn it. This is the second week in a row. All right,
what's
Greg.
Going on? We've been doing this for more than a year.
Greg.
Yes, so in the spirit of the Wii U's journey being complete, I thought we'd just...
Viking funeral? we set on fire in a boat?
I thought we'd remember some of the good times with tonight's musical choice. So Super Mario 3D World, unbelievable soundtrack. Actually haven't used a song from it yet in the year that we've been doing this. We did have a sort of something that's based off it, a Mario & Sonic remix, but this is straight up from that wonderful soundtrack. The pure audio distilled joy poured into your ears of Chainlink Charge. So, you know, the Wii U might be gone, but we'll always be able to remember it through some of its sensational soundtracks.
And on that, for real this time, it's time to end the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Meow.
God damn it.
Game of competitive cat noises is going to start.